Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Kate Veach, who reads from and discusses her new book, Without a Backward Glance, published by Plume. In the weeks to come, we have Martin Troost, David Carr, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my great pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Our guest tonight is Kate Veach, who is here to present her debut novel, Without a Backward Glance. In Australia, where she hails from, this novel is entitled Listen, and rightly so, we should give a listen to this new novelist. And if you wouldn't mind, listen to these reviews. Booklist says, similar to Anne Tyler in her wry affection for her characters and to Anita Shreve in her aptitude for crafting compulsively readable plot lines, first novelist Kate Veach delivers a remarkably assured debut that is sure to find a ready audience. Library Journal says, Veach has written a powerful and engrossing story of family interactions, complete with family members' frailties and strengths. Chock-a-block with rich, idiomatic Australian slang, this novel also includes a glossary, unquote. And speaking of the glossary, please note that Kate is not big-noting herself here with these reviews. You can check out that saying in the glossary. Kate seems to find enthusiastic readers everywhere she goes, readers who devoured this book in just a couple of days or reading it into the wee hours of the night. She has written for the Sydney Morning Herald and Vogue Australia. She was the producer of Their Brilliant Careers, a series on women's writers for Australia's Radio National. We are so glad that she has made the long trip to the U.S. and has included the Tattered Cover in her book tour. Please welcome Kate Veach.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Christine, and thank you for the warm welcome that I have had since my arrival in Denver about 4 hours ago. I really have had nothing but just lovely people being so kind and welcoming. The Tattered Cover is a bookshop that I am very proud to be reading at. I didn't know about the Tattered Cover until a few months ago when I was in Bali working on my second novel, and I had just received the schedule of this tour from my publicist. And that day I happened to meet some people who are here tonight, Steve and Linda, who were at a neighbouring hotel. I mentioned what I did. I mentioned that I was going to the US. They said, are you going to Denver? And I said, yes. Tattered Cover? And I said, yes. And they said, oh, it's the most wonderful bookshop. When I was on my way back from Bali to Australia, I was stuck in a long queue at Melbourne Airport. The woman behind me hailed from Denver. She said, I hope you're going to the Tattered Cover. I said, oh, yes, of course, I wouldn't miss the Tattered Cover. And since then I have heard nothing but the most wonderful reports, and it is clearly a marvellous bookstore. Thank you for having me. Tonight what I plan to do is to read from the prologue of my novel, Without a Backward Glance, and then perhaps we could have a wee chat. I'm willing to answer absolutely any questions. There's almost nothing I won't talk about, including where I buy my lingerie, no problem. And then, time permitting, and I'm confident that there will be, I'd like to read perhaps another shorter section, if you would all like that. But please, don't hold back on the questions. The other section is quite short. So, can I set the scene for you with this reading? The prologue is set in 1967. Rosemary is a young Englishwoman. She fell pregnant to, and ran away with an older man, an Australian, leaving behind a London that was grey, drab, post-war, rationed, and thoroughly unappealing. She was going to the land of milk and honey. Now, 12 years later, she finds herself the mother of four children, stuck in the suburbs of Melbourne, which I can tell you at that time was a very conservative town. We forget just how much has changed, how much changed so soon after that. At that time, a woman who was employed by the Australian Public Service, if she married, she had to resign. There was no choice. Really, the only choices for women once they had married, there were really no careers except possibly teaching, possibly nursing. But to have a career in those days was virtually impossible. Things were about to change in Australia 5 years later with the election of a new government. But what had already changed was the London that Rosemarie had left behind. And that is what she is pining for. Carnaby Street, the Beatles, thigh-high vinyl boots, pop art earrings. She is a gifted seamstress, and that's where she wants to be, at the nexus of fashion and pop. But she isn't. She is in Australia on Christmas Eve. It's swelteringly hot, as it is in Australia on Christmas Eve, the seasons being reversed to what they are here. The sun was finally setting, and Rosemarie had asked Robert to hose the patio, so now it was cool and wet underfoot. Quite pleasant, really, she surprised herself by thinking, in a sloppy Australian way. The kids were excited by the unexpected company. Oh, Rosemarie's husband Alex has met the neighbours at the fish and chip shop, the middle-aged neighbours, and brought them home for an impromptu supper. And although Robert watched with a hawk's eye as Deborah doled out their servings like a sergeant, "No, Meredith, just two potato cakes, and you have to eat your flake," he didn't challenge her. No bickering, no complaints from the kids as they sat on the patio steps, happily eating with their fingers in the gathering dusk. The evening suddenly had a party feel. The adults were happy and excited too, and chatty around the outdoor table. Joyce placed a confiding hand on Rosemarie's forearm. "I've been so wanting to see you, dear, and tell you about the Christmas party at John's work. I wore that new cocktail frock you made me." "The pink one?" "The pink one," Joyce confirmed, "with the green bolero. Rosemarie, I will never again even hesitate over one of your suggestions. I don't think I've ever had so many compliments on a frock in my life. Even more than from the mother of the bride outfit you made me for Leonie's wedding." "Oh, Joyce, I am so pleased to hear that." "I gave your telephone number to three different ladies. I hope that's all right." "It certainly is. Of course, you know how I love to sew. And how I love to tuck the money away in my own little bank account," she thinks to herself. This is all in italics. People think in italics in my book. "I don't know how you do it. I mean, I can follow a pattern, but how you make these things up out of your own head, it's just marvellous." "Do you think so?" said Rosemarie, smiling. "You think that's marvellous? These little outfits? If I'd stayed in London, I could be designing for one of the trendsetters now, Mary Quant or Bieber. Even here, if I got just half the backing a local girl like Prue Acton's had, I could have my own label, like her." "She's not just a pretty face, my little wifey," said Alex proudly, opening another bottle of beer and refilling their glasses. "Joyce, would you like some green beans for your dinner tomorrow? I'll be picking some fresh in the morning." "That's so nice of you to offer, but actually we're going to Leonie's tomorrow." "Oh, that's something different." "She's so proud of the new house she and Dennis have built," said John. "She was keen as mustard to have Christmas dinner there, and we thought, well, why not? Do something different." "How very daring of you," thought Rosemarie, all her discontent flaring up again. "What about your family, Alex? Got anyone coming?" "As a matter of fact, we do. My brother Bob and his wife Joan are coming over. That'll be nice. It will be nice, Alex agreed, nodding. I'm thinking, said Rosemary suddenly, I'm thinking of getting some labels woven to put in the garments I make. Joyce stared at her, puzzled. Labels? With what? To say what? The designer. You know, me. You? Your name? Well, Rosemary gave a little laugh, trying to sound casual. John Grounds was staring at her too now, though Alex, at the end of the table closest to the steps, had twisted sideways in his chair and was looking at the kids. Well, Rosemary MacDonald might be a bit long. I was thinking something shorter. Actually, she had been thinking that Rose Red would be charming and memorable, but now she didn't want to say that. I just don't think, said Joyce uncertainly. Listen, pet, said John kindly, leaning toward Rosemary, you don't want to look like you're big-noting yourself. Not here. People won't like it. His wife nodded emphatic confirmation. Rosemary felt herself blush fiercely from the collarbones up. Her throat and face were on fire. She hoped desperately that in the deepening dusk no one would see. Did you hear that? Asked Alex, turning back to them. The kids are trying to guess what we've got them for Christmas, but really they haven't got a clue. He gave a happy chuckle. God, I love Christmas. It's such a great time for the kids. And what have you got them? Asked John. Alex leaned in closer. New bikes, he said softly, for all of them. Oh, aren't they lucky, said Joyce. She took a decent swig from her glass of beer and turned to her silent hostess. What about your own family, Rosemary? Her voice was overbright, like an adult trying to cheer up a grumpy child. Do you ever have anyone come over from England? There was a little pause before Rosemary could make herself respond. No, it's so far to come, you know. Well, yes, it is, of course. Suddenly she wanted to shove a sharp elbow into their cosiness, these nice middle-aged people, her husband, their friends. And I didn't exactly make myself popular, you know, running away with an old man. Oh. The table stilled, but it wasn't enough. I was only 17, after all, and pregnant. We said some very hard things to each other, my mum and dad and me. Oh. They'd trusted Alex, you see. He was working with my dad on a bridge project. That's how they met, how we met. It was almost completely dark now, and the silence around the table was profound. Suddenly, the outside lights snapped on, and they all flinched at the glare. Deborah was standing by the back door, her hand still resting on the wall beside the switch. "It's got too dark," she said loudly. Did she hear? Rosemary wondered, but Deborah's expression was giving nothing away. Defiantly, Rosemary glanced from face to face around the table, but they were all looking in different directions, and no one at her. Joyce reached out and started to gather plates. John made a little coughing noise, a let's all get on together noise. We're thinking of going to my cousin's holiday place down at Rosebud for a few days around New Year. Maybe you could bring the kids down one day. Oh, that's a top-notch suggestion, cried Alex gratefully. Kids, what do you think of this idea? The younger children came over and leaned against their father as he and John put to them the enticing prospect of a day at the beach. Deborah collected the kids' messy, abandoned plates from the patio steps and, as she passed her mother, said, There's a brick of Neapolitan ice cream in the freezer, Mum. Shall I get it out for dessert? Yes, thank you. Rosemary followed her daughter into the kitchen, a clutter of bottles in her arms. She felt almost ill with shame and defiance. Why did I have to say that? What earthly good did it do? You're such a help to me, Deborah. Sometimes I think you could run this family on your own. She nudged her daughter's shoulder gratefully, and the girl dipped her head in acknowledgement. They stood side by side for a moment, looking through the window at the scene on the patio, the three older people talking animatedly again, Meredith snuggled in her father's lap, James draped over his shoulders. Robert was leaning forward attentively in the chair beside him. "Robert's fingering again," observed Deborah, and yes, Rosemary could just make out the tight, repetitive patterns of Robert's hands, moving his fingers to and fro, in and out, making cat's cradles out of thin air. His subtle, so annoying habit. She clicked her tongue and sighed. "Oh, he'll wear his fingerprints clean off, I swear," she said. "Ah, let him go, Deb. Don't say anything." They both turned away. "What about the stewed apricots, Mum? Shall we have those too?" John and Joyce Grounds had gone home. The dishes were done. The children were putting the finishing touches to their presents. Alex hadn't said much. Now he hung the damp tea towel on the rail and turned to his wife. She lifted her chin to take whatever was coming. "Give me a good ticking off," she thought. "I deserve it. After all, it was my fault too, what happened back then. I wanted you too, and I so wanted you to carry me off to the other side of the world, to the land of sunshine and plenty." "I know it's late," her husband said, "but it's the best time for watering in this weather. I want to give the fruit trees a good soak." "Oh, all right then." Rosemary's shoulders sagged as he went out through the laundry. The screen door squeaked and then slammed. She felt like a balloon that had been overinflated and was now slowly coming down. She could almost hear the soft hiss. She wandered into the living room, sat down in her usual chair. The children started bringing their presents out, carrying them in a little procession from the bedroom and depositing them fussily around the base of the Christmas tree. The tree was decorated with a mixture of delicate glass ornaments, a fixture of Alex's childhood Christmases, and the children's own handmade decorations, yards and yards of paper chains in alternating red and green, cutouts of snowflakes and stars and reindeer, and a wonky glittering angel with a tinsel halo perched right at the top. The kids looked at each other and lined up self-consciously in front of the tree, facing her. "Would you like us to sing you a Christmas carol, Mum?" asked Robert importantly. "Yes, I would," she answered, folding her hands in her lap. "Very much." "Where's Daddy?" asked Meredith, glancing about. "Watering the fruit trees. He'll be a while." "We'll just start then." Robert turned slightly to count the others in. 1, 2, 3. "O come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant, come ye to Bethlehem." They were surprisingly good. Even little Meredith kept up pretty well. James's voice was particularly pleasant, Rosemary thought, and his face was just entrancing. Relaxed as always and poised to smile. Already so handsome, the crisp dark hair, the blue eyes raised as he sang, the rosy perfect skin. "The good fairy kissed you on the forehead," she thought. "You'll have a charmed life, and I'll never need to worry about you." Robert, on the other hand, had his eyes fixed anxiously on her, the muscles in his skinny neck standing out. He was so tense, she could hardly bear to look at him. She felt ashamed and made herself smile, then was stricken anew at the way his face lit up. "What a good kid you are. You're all good kids, really. You try so hard to make me happy, you poor things." He sang a little louder and Deborah shot him a look, plainly longing to tell him to pipe down. Amazing that she'd let him be in charge for even a moment. They finished. Robert bowed and the others all raggedly followed. Rosemary clapped hard, and while she was still clapping, a car pulled into the driveway. The motor stopped and the headlights were turned off, but no one got out. The kids hurtled over to kneel on the couch and gaze out the window. Who's that? Is it Uncle Bob? No, silly, his car's not like that. I'll go and see, said Rosemary. They watched their mother at the driver's window, ducking her head to talk to someone in the car they couldn't see. Suddenly, she turned and walked quickly back into the house. They heard her go into her bedroom and close the door. They sat together on the couch, facing the tree now, waiting. A few minutes later, Rosemary reappeared in the doorway of the living room. She had changed from her pretty cotton frock into slacks and a smart top. She was holding her big yellow handbag. "I'm just going to get some lights for the Christmas tree," she said. Her eyes, bright and hectic, swept across them. Then she turned and was gone. The four children turned too, as one, kneeling on the couch again to watch their mother hurry to the stranger's car. She was carrying the tan suitcase with the dark brown stripe, the one that usually sat on top of the big wardrobe. She heaved the case into the back seat and climbed in after it. The car's headlights came on again. It reversed down the driveway and drove off up the street. The children were still kneeling there after the sound of the motor had well and truly faded away. Their father came into the room, and slowly they slid down and turned to face him. "Where's your mother?" Alex asked. And that's the end of the prologue. Thank you. The next is chapter one, and we've shot forward nearly 40 years to meet the adult children and their father and the grandchildren and really everyone except Rosemary, who hasn't been seen nor heard from since. Just to entice you. So, apart from lingerie... Chet.
Your examination of family life, has it given you some perspective about family life in general in the world, in society? It always seems, authors seem to be able to capture the greatness of family life, but yet it seems as though we have an idea.
Yes, I do think it's, certainly for me, it's been a two-way process, that's for sure. When I had the idea for this book and wrote it, wrote the first draft, which also I wrote in Bali in 2004, at that time I had only ever met one family where the mother had walked out. What I had myself was a mother who, like Rosemary, was an intelligent, ambitious, talented woman who was indeed trapped in the suburbs of Melbourne with four children in 1967, although those children are not me and my siblings, and Rosemary is not my mother. My mother never walked out, although I'll bet there were many times when she probably wished that she could. But there was no way that she could do that. Why I chose that extremely dramatic family situation of an abandoning mother was because my mother's own unhappiness was never resolved, and in fact became chronic depression, which, like many depressed people, she self-medicated with alcohol. Between the depression and the alcoholism, all of us kids came increasingly to have the feeling of a mother who was absent. Although she was physically there, in many ways, spiritually, emotionally, she was not. And so I had the idea, what would it be like to grow up with a mother who physically wasn't there, not through death, but through the same sorts of reasons that my mother was absent in so many ways, the constricting mores of the times and her own ill-suitedness to being a full-time mother, which, as I kind of mentioned before, was pretty much all that was available to you then. Men could be fathers and still have any of the multiplicity of careers that were open to them. Women, once they became wives and mothers, in that era, that was still pretty much it. And it is not a life that suits everybody. And so that was what I chose to write about. What has totally astounded me since then, and this has been the real learning experience for me, is the number of people who have approached me in Australia and here to say, this is part of my family story. My mother walked out. My grandmother walked out. I met a woman in Austin a couple of weeks ago who told me that her great-grandmother had walked out. And this information is almost always kept secret, in a way that that the departure, the abandonment of a father, is not a secret. It's by no means unusual. It's still maybe tragic and reap devastating consequences on the family for a father to walk out, but it is by no means unusual, and it is not something that people feel they have to keep secret. But the shame, the horror almost, of a mother who abandons her own children, not because of abuse, not because of lack because of poverty, but because of her own personality. This has been something that many people have reacted very powerfully to. A lot of people have expressed great compassion for Rosemarie. They've said it really made them think about what it is to be a mother, what the pressures are, and what they were too. Something else that's really quite has been an education for me is how many people find it impossible to countenance forgiveness, even for a fictional character. They can't, that for them, the hurt that she caused is unforgivable, and they feel so strongly about it. The feedback that I've had from writers' groups has been amazing. It clearly is a book that speaks very strongly to writers' groups when women in particular get the opportunity to talk about this situation among themselves. It clearly leads to some extremely powerful discussions. And in a way, yeah, it's been a big education for me how potent abandonment is. I think that it speaks to something very deep within us, something about survival, because let's face it, for centuries, millennia, if your mother died in childbirth, which was probably, you know, much more the source of abandonment, or you were otherwise left motherless, your chances of survival plummeted. It really depended on having a mother. Your chances of survival now are, you know, much better, but I actually have come to think that there may be some deeply kind of anachronistic but very powerful thing that says a mother must never leave her children, no matter what. And I would like to hear more compassion and forgiveness, but it's made me think a lot about why that's so hard for people to arrive at. That was a rather long-winded answer to your question. Is there time for me to read another shorter piece? Since I've just been talking about that, I might read a piece that's actually about the dementia, if people don't mind. Here we meet Alex as an old man. He's over 80 now. And we meet his granddaughter, Olivia. She's a very self-possessed young woman. Well, she's only 13, but she's 13 going on 30. You know, she's just one of those, you know, born middle-aged sort of people. They're very close to each other. They have two major things in common, their love of dogs and their love of gardening. Olivia often goes over with her dogs to see her, to spend time at her grandpa's place and garden with him. On this morning, Easter Saturday, she's gone over without the dogs, and here she is. Oh, her parents and aunts and uncles know about the dementia, but because they're all a family so accustomed to keeping secrets, they have all automatically kept it from her. So she has not been made privy to the real facts about his dementia. Grandpa was sitting in the old wooden chair down the end of the garden with an empty teacup and crusts of toast on a tray and the Saturday paper on his lap. "Hello there, Honey Bunch," he said, looking very pleased. "Well, isn't this wonderful? I was just thinking about you. See here," and he tapped a spot on the newspaper. Olivia came around beside him and read the item, in the gardening pages, of course, aloud over his shoulders. "Open for today only. Golden Grove. This fabled garden, never before opened to the public, was the life's work of Constance Yule, who died last year, age 91. Miss Yule was a gifted amateur botanist and collected many rare plant specimens in China, Burma, and Nepal. An outstanding feature of Golden Grove is the spectacular dahlia garden, at its peak now. The Yule family is opening Golden Grove in honour of their aunt and to raise money for the orphanage, which she supported in a refugee camp on the Thai-Burma border. Well, Ollie, what do you think?" "Sounds fabulous, Grandpa. I bet those dahlias took a beating, though, in that storm the other night." "True, true. But, you know, I've been hearing about this garden for years. I've always wanted to have a good look at it." "Okay. And I haven't brought the dogs with me today, which is good. Where is it?" She looked in the newspaper again. "Ah, that's over near Auntie Meredith's place. How'll we get there?" "In my car, of course, darling. I can still drive all right, you know. I just pick my times when the roads aren't so full of maniacs. But Easter Saturday will be nice and quiet." Olivia hesitated. Wasn't there some problem she'd heard mentioned about Grandpa driving? But his car was still there in the carport, so it must be all right. And they hadn't been out on an excursion like this for ages. "Golden Grove," he said wonderingly, looking again at the little piece in the newspaper. "Okay, Grandpa," she said, "let's go." It took him a couple of tries to back out of the carport, and somehow the passenger side mirror got a bit of a bang. Didn't break, though. He had used the street directory to pre-plan their route, and Olivia had it open to the page on her lap as he drove. He gripped the steering wheel hard, staring ahead with utmost concentration, but within minutes there was a blast on the horn from a car which then swept past them. Pretty soon the next car behind was tooting and flashing its lights at them as well. "Bloody maniacs," Alex said, clearly flustered. "What's the matter with them?" "You could go a bit faster, Grandpa," suggested Olivia. "This is a 60-kilometre zone, I think." "I'm going fast enough." "You're only doing..." She leaned across to look at the gauges in front of him. 30? "That's fast enough," he shouted. "How bloody fast do you want me to go?" Olivia flinched and said nothing. Grandpa never spoke to her like that. He did drive a little faster for a while, but then slowed right down again, and other drivers continued to get cross. She was very pleased to get to Golden Grove, well marked with signs. There were cars already parked for a long way around. As they walked toward the entrance, she noticed that his hands were shaking. "Grandpa," she said, "are you all right?" "Sorry, doll. Just upsets me, all those rude so-and-sos on the road these days. They've got a name for it too, you know. I just can't think what it is." "You mean road rage?" "Could be something like that." "Never mind," he said, making a visible effort to calm himself, to smile. "That's modern times, eh?" They paid the entrance fee, Alex graciously accepting the invitation to donate something extra to the orphanage in Burma, and were given a map of the property. Devonshire tea's being served all day in the gazebo. That's marked there, near the Michaelias. Do you see? Said the woman on the gate, indicating the spot on the map. Thank you. A cuppa might come in very handy. Thirsty work, this, said Alex gamely. They went in and strolled around for a while, admiring this and that, but Olivia could tell her grandfather was still unsettled. She spotted a garden seat, temptingly located in dappled shade, and there, somewhat farther away, was the gazebo. Grandpa, see that seat over there, she said. How about you grab that while I go and get you a cup of tea? That's a good idea, Ollie, he said gratefully, fishing his wallet out from his back pocket. Here, you get a lemonade or something too, won't you? It took her ages, absolutely ages, to get served. Olivia started to feel anxious. As she made her way back to the garden seat, carrying a laden tray, she was relieved to see that her grandfather was still there. Maybe he was dozing. His shoulders appeared to be slumped, and his head was tilted to one side. But as she came closer, she was shocked to see that tears were rolling down his cheeks, his mouth open in unabashed distress. "Oh, Grandpa," she cried, "what's the matter?" She sat beside him, and he took one of her hands, sobbing. There was a hanky in the pocket of his shirt, and she took it out and shook it open, pressing it into his hand. He mopped at his face, still crying. "What should I do?" she asked herself desperately. "Should I get help? But Grandpa would hate that." Finally he spoke. "I'm terribly worried about my father," he said. His voice sounded like something had broken inside him. It caught at her heart. "I've been thinking about him, and it doesn't seem like I've heard from him for such a long time." He looked at her with a sad, piteous hope. "Do you know where he is?" "Your father, Grandpa?" she asked. He nodded, gazing at her. "Oh, what should I say?" "The truth, I suppose. What else can I say?" "I'm afraid your father's dead, Grandpa. He died quite a long time ago, when Mum was just little. She told me, maybe 40 years ago now." "Dead?" Alex said. He looked down at his lap and gave a long, shuddering sigh. "Yes," he agreed sadly. "Yes, I suppose he is. I think you might have had a dream about him, Grandpa. Maybe you had a little nap here on the bench and had a dream about him." "Yes, I suppose I did." He sounded completely worn out. "I went to get us a Devonshire tea. See? How about you drink this cuppa? I think it'll make you feel better." "Yes, I'll do that," he said. They sat, Alex drinking his tea quietly, Olivia the lemonade. "Auntie Meredith's place just near here," she thought, "and hopefully Lawrence will be home too. We just have to get there and then we'll be okay." Thank you. Thank you.
I had a question about the title change.
Oh, go ask. Do you want to ask? Or?
Okay, I'll ask.
Yeah.
What is the process of the title change from Australia to the US for the rights?
Well, in Australia, the book was called Listen, L-I-S-T-E-N, Listen. And if you read the prologue, you'll actually see where I got the idea from. It's from a Beatles song. The one, Listen, I won't try and sing again. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Because there are so many secrets in this book. And everyone in Australia was very happy with that title. And it was a bestseller in Australia, so who can complain, you know? Then it was published in Germany and they changed the title there. Well, I understand that things can't just be translated. The title they chose there was Ein Leben lang, which I probably haven't pronounced correctly, but it has the meaning of lifelong. And my publisher there explained to me that it has the meaning of lifelong with a sense of love. you know, that the lifelong ties of love that bind family members together no matter what. And I thought that was a beautiful title. And it was a bestseller in Germany too, so who can complain about that? Now, when it was bought by Plume Publishers here, my publisher told me that she started to get a negative response to the title Listen in-house. People there at Plume didn't like it. They described it as a bit too quiet, or more brutally, dull. I thought, well, okay. And in fact, none of the Americans I spoke to seemed to like it. I must admit, and I don't want to be mean, but an Australian friend of mine who works in publishing in New York said, Americans don't much like to listen. And I thought, you know, although she was being flippant, I did think, I wonder if, you know, Americans are trained to speak out and to be very forthcoming, really from childhood, in a way that's not the case in Australia. And I wondered if the activity of listen is actually seen not as an activity here, but as something rather passive, and that listen is privileged as a more, sorry, that speaking is privileged over listening as being a more active. I'm getting some nods here. Well, I wonder about that because, you know, I can't see how you can train children up to speak and to be applauded for every little thing they do. We don't do that in Australia. No. We don't have high school graduations or anything like that. It's just like, you finished school? Good. Get on with your life, you know. So I really wondered about that. We went through about 100 different titles, emailing each other back and forth. And, yeah, it was a bit agonising. And then she found a phrase in the book, without a backward glance. And I immediately emailed her back and said, wow, straight to the shortlist with that one. And it was the unanimous choice in-house, in Plume. Now, I like the title and I love the cover. I think they've done a beautiful job with the cover. But I'll tell you what, I have actually found that here in the US, the response that I've been getting focuses very much on Rosemary's act of abandonment, her leaving without a backward glance. In Australia, on the other hand, I had a much more diverse range of responses. You know, people responded to the sibling stuff. They responded incredibly strongly to the dementia thing. They responded to the dogs. They responded to the granddaughter. They, you know, I mean, when people get into this book and personal responses to it I've had have been more diverse. But the initial and powerful response is to the abandonment. And now I'm beginning to wonder if maybe it wasn't such a good choice after all. How much does a title focus the reader on the contents of the book? And I'm beginning to wonder if I didn't make a big mistake, because I don't want it to be all about the abandonment. You know, listen is so much more kind of empathetic, and it doesn't privilege any one character or action over another. So now I'm kind of wishing that I'd either fought harder to stay with listen, even if people had to really strain their ears to hear it, or chosen some other title that didn't focus so strongly on one action. So after you've had a chance to read the book, I'd love to have your thoughts on that.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fodor, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Martin Troost, David Carr, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on August 4th, 2008.